Today we come to the 15th and last lecture of the series, The Role of the State in Domestic and Foreign Trade and Industry. First, I wish to deal with the relation of foreign trade to peace and war. In his farewell address to the American nation, delivered by television and radio, on January the 17th, 1961, our late and beloved President Dwight Eisenhower warned us of the growing threat to our historic liberties and the rule of law, of what he termed the military-industrial complex, even then dominating American society. Eisenhower said, and I quote, "Until the latest of our world complex, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But now we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security more than the net income of all United States corporations. This conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, and even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we mustn't fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together." End of quote. These words of Eisenhower still touch a live nerve in our politics and in the American conscience. To many Americans, the military-industrial complex is rightly a source of deep concern. There is widespread anxiety that its influence, brought to bear on the appropriations mechanism in the Congress, may thwart the will of the majority, particularly in the matter of diverting greater resources from military to economic and social purposes. Eisenhower's thesis that there existed in our country a military-industrial complex has been documented by numerous scholars, especially Seymour Melman. I refer you to his book, Pentagon Capitalism, the Political Economy of War. Page 2, please. If what President Eisenhower had to say is true, as I think it is, then the United States is well on the way to becoming a totalitarian democracy. Totalitarianism can best be understood as the permanent organization of society for war. The military ethic and habit of mind is by nature anti-democratic and authoritarian. The more widespread and longer sustained such a discipline becomes in a democratic society, the less likely that society is to remain democratic and free. Is it not most significant that the longest period of peace in modern times, from the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815 to the outbreak of the First World War in 1914, was also the great era of limited government and of free trade between the nations? The more power the central government of a nation obtains over its people, the more likely it will engage in war. On this relationship between peace and freedom and war and statism, Ayn Rand has commented as follows, and I quote, "Statism needs war. A free country does not. Statism survives by looting. A free country survives by production. Observe the major wars of history were started by the more controlled economies of the time against the freer ones. Now, for instance, World War I was started by monarchist Germany and Tsarist Russia, who dragged in their freer allies. World War II was started by the alliance of Nazi Germany with Soviet Russia and their joint attack on Poland. Germany and Russia needed war. The United States did not and gained nothing. In fact, the United States lost economically, even though it won the war. It was left with an enormous national debt. Yet it is capitalism that today's peace lovers oppose and statism that they advocate in the name of peace. Laissez-faire capitalism, says Ayn Rand, is the only social system based on the recognition of individual rights and therefore the only system that bans force from social relationships. By the nature of its basic principles and interests, it is the only system fundamentally opposed to war. Men who are free to produce have no incentive to loot. They have nothing to gain from war and a great deal to lose. Economically, wars cost money. In a free economy, where wealth is privately owned, the costs of war come out of the income of private citizens. There is no overblown public treasury to hide that fact. And a citizen cannot hope to recoup his own financial losses by winning the war. Thus, his own economic interests are on the side of peace. In a statist economy, where wealth is publicly owned, a citizen has no economic interests to protect by preserving peace. He is only a drop in the common bucket, while war gives him the fallacious hope of larger handouts from his masters. Ideologically, he is trained to regard men as sacrificial animals. He is one himself. He can have no concept of why foreigners should not be sacrificed on the same public altar for the benefit of the same state." She continues, "The trader and the warrior have been fundamental antagonists throughout history. Trade doesn't flourish on battlefields. Factories don't produce bombardments. Profits do not grow on rubble. Capitalism is a society of traders, for which it has been denounced by the every would-be gunman who regards trade as selfish and conquest as noble. Just as in domestic affairs, all the evils caused by statism and government controls were blamed on capitalism and the free market, so in foreign affairs, all the evils of statist policies were blamed on and ascribed to capitalism. Such myths as capitalistic imperialism or war profiteering are examples of the superficiality or the unscrupulousness of statist commentators and historians. The essence of capitalism's foreign policy is free trade, that is, the abolition of trade barriers, of protective tariffs, of special privileges, the opening of the world's trade routes to international exchange and competition among the private citizens of all countries dealing directly with one another. During the 19th century, it was free trade that liberated the world, undercutting and wrecking the remnants of feudalism and the status tyranny of absolute monarchs." I think you can read the rest of that quotation for yourself. Ayn Rand goes on to show that the rise of a spirit of nationalistic imperialism in the United States did not come from conservatives, but from the collectivist reformers who influenced the policies of Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, and above all, Franklin D. Roosevelt. For a history of these influences, she quotes Arthur Eichrodt's The Decline of American Liberalism, who says, "In such instances as the progressives' increasing acceptance of compulsory military training and of the white man's burden, there were obvious reminders of the paternalism of much of their economic reform legislation." End of quote. Just as Wilson, a liberal reformer, led the United States into World War I, quote, "to make the world safe for democracy," so F.D. Roosevelt led our nation into World War II in the name of the four freedoms. In both cases, the conservatives were overwhelmingly opposed to war, but were silenced or accused of being isolationists and even reactionaries. Ayn Rand's thesis has received support from an unexpected quarter. The neo-Marxist American revisionist historian William A. Williams, in The Roots of the Modern American Empire, and some presidents, Wilson to Nixon, sees the presidency as having evolved into the chairman of the board of the corporate state of the American version of fascism. In his view, the course of American history in the 20th century has been a working out of the realization that the new corporate political economy could not function without intimate and extensive collaboration between corporation leaders and the president, or without subsidies supplied by the taxpayer. In the past 60 years, the power of the executive has been employed to maintain the system despite its failure during the Depression to maintain full employment, and despite the fact that a majority of Americans may well have opposed it. Williams concludes most chillingly, in that process, leadership steadily degenerated into manipulation. Dialogue was subverted by secrecy and evasion. Trust was undermined by lies, and the residue of confidence was further eroded by incompetence and failure. From there, the steps that led America into involvement in Southeast Asia and the Watergate affair were simple enough. Please turn over the page. So we have then President Eisenhower warning the nation of the dangers involved in the military-industrial complex. We have Ayn Rand also warning us of the encroachment of the power state on our liberties, and we have Mr. Williams doing the same. And so the question arises, has America become a fascist democracy, or a capitalist corporate state, or a socialist state? Now, we're not going to be able to decide as to what is the reformed biblical view of the role of the state in our society until we make up our minds as to what exactly our society is becoming or has become. Now, according to many right-wing thinkers, America is rapidly moving towards a socialist economy. In support of this thesis, they point to the growing intervention of the federal and state governments in the operation of our economy. Yet, in actual fact, America is moving away from the free market economy of laissez-faire capitalism towards a fascist-type economy. Socialism and communism are both systems of social organization which advocate the vesting of the ownership and the control of all the means of production, exchange, and distribution in the hands of the state. The main difference between communism and socialism of the Western European variety is that the former favors violent revolution to achieve its objective, while the latter believes democratic means should be used to obtain power. A good example used by American conservatives is the British Labour government, which came into office after World War II. It is towards this democratic type of socialism the American economist Edwin Mansfield thinks our country is moving. He writes in Economics, Principles, Problems, and Decisions, published this year, and I quote, "To a considerable extent, the more capitalist countries like the United States have taken over many of the socialist programs. For example, the United States has moved a long way toward heavy taxation of the rich and toward extensive welfare programs. Even though planning remains a dirty word in the United States, the government has become more and more involved in various aspects of our economic life." End of quote. In actual fact, of course, by the socialist's own definition, the United States is nowhere near becoming a socialist state. On the contrary, many left-wing economists, such as John Kenneth Galbraith in The New Industrial State, Economics and the Public Purpose, and the left-wing historians, such as Williams in the books we have discussed, and Gabriel Coco in The Triumph of Conservatism, argue that America has become a corporate capitalist state. In Galbraith's view of the corporate state, there is a partnership between the world of big business and big government and big unionism, which makes the proper functioning of the state itself very difficult. The state in America, he claims, now functions in the first place for the benefit of the corporate sector to the detriment of the rest of society. Neither our left wing nor our right wing economists and historians are willing to face up to the truth that the United States in practice, and not in theory, has become a fascist state. By fascism we mean a political and economic system with strong centralized power, with the state claiming the role of part and with big business and big unions in the operation of the economic, social, and political system of a given country. Both socialism and fascism involve the use of property rights. Now, the right to property is the right of use and disposal. Socialism negates private property rights altogether and advocates, at least as its ultimate objective, quote, the vesting of ownership and control of all the means of production, exchange, and distribution in the hands of the state. Fascism, on the other hand, leaves legal ownership in the hands of private individuals or corporations, but transfers control of such property to the government bureaucrats. It is this tendency which has characterized America's so-called mixed economy since its first introduction during the administration of President Woodrow Wilson, as we saw with the founding of the Federal Reserve System in 1913 and the introduction of federal income tax. Thus, the Federal Reserve System was a partnership between certain big banks in the country and the federal government. Today, vital decisions affecting every business in the nation are being made by federal bureaucrats in Washington. For example, the control of the railroad, the airline, management-labor relations, minimum wage rates, wage and price controls, not to mention tariffs and quotas and interest rates, etc. Such ownership without control is, of course, a contradiction in terms. It means property without the right to use it or to dispose of it as the owner himself thinks fit. It means citizens retain the responsibility of holding property rights without any of its advantages, while the federal government acquires all the advantages of control without any of the responsibility. Then I go on to show how this mixed economy, as the liberal economists politely call it, or what I prefer to call more honestly, the fascist economy, developed out of the teachings of the German philosopher Hegel and out of the Roman Catholic view of the corporate state. Please turn to page 7. We come to the reform doctrine of sphere sovereignty. Now, the reform Christian rejects both the fascist and the socialist variety of totalitarianism, since he believes that God alone can rightfully claim absolute sovereignty over individuals as well as over all nation states. As servants of Christ the King, Christians are obliged by their baptismal vows to reject any form of statism, whether fascist, socialist, or communist, which would make the state the whole of which all other social relationships, such as church, art, science, education, commerce, and industry, are only the subservient parts. This absolutization and deification of the modern nation state has been the curse of our age and the basic reason for the terrible wars of the 20th century. The nation states of our age have justified their right to wage total war over other nations in the name of this pernicious Hegelian doctrine of absolute sovereignty. Now, Hegel, for example, once said, "The state is God walking upon earth." The nations have, in effect, claimed to be God over their people. It is this claim which really made possible the total wars of our age, since it enabled governments to draft millions of men into the armed services to take over the entire economy of each nation at war. As each government has increased its powers over its citizens by such means as universal military conscription and higher taxation and direct control of the economy, so the intensity and scope of war has increased. Anyone who doubts its relationship between the growing power of the modern nation state and the intensity of the wars of our age should read Bertrand de Jouvenal's sobering book on power. And I might add Professor Corwin's a great work, Total War and the Constitution. That's Corwin, C-O-R-W-I-N, Total War and the Constitution. Corwin, as you know, is one of America's greatest experts on our Constitution. Nothing would do more for the peace and trade of mankind than for the peoples of the world to withdraw the absolute and total allegiance they have given to their governments and give it instead to the Lord Jesus Christ, who alone can be trusted not to abuse such total power over men. The absolutization of the modern nation state, including the United States, is completely at variance with the fundamental motive of the Christian religion. Only the God and Father of the Lord Jesus Christ can thus claim to be the absolute sovereign over men. No bearer of authority on this earth is the highest power from which other forms of authority are derived. Ultimate sovereignty belongs to God alone. Please turn to the back of your paper. We have a diagrammatic representation of this Calvinist doctrine of sphere sovereignty. We'll deal first of all with the one in the middle, the pagan humanist view based on the nature of freedom ground motive. And this goes right back to the ancient Greeks, and this theory was revived at the time of the Renaissance. And notice in the humanist view, whether left-wing or right-wing, whether liberal or conservative, the state is seen as the all-encompassing sovereign whole, of which church and family and school and labor union, business firm and other associations are considered to be only the part. Then, during the Middle Ages, the Roman Catholic Church gained the ascendancy in medieval society, and they simply took over the old Greek humanist theory of the state and added around it the all-encompassing sovereign papal church. But the significant point is the Roman Catholic theologians, which is Aquinas, divided life up between nature and grace, and they put the realm of the state and the family and the school and so on into the realm of the natural, leaving the church affairs in the realm of grace and the sacred and supernatural. At the Reformation, a fundamental break took place with both the Roman Catholic view of society and the pagan humanist view. Calvin, for example, distinguished between a realm of things indifferent, the realm of the Ediophora, in which he placed education and science and business and art and so on, and he said that over this realm of the things indifferent, neither the church as institution, that is the clergy, nor the government or its officials had or should have any say. On the contrary, thought Calvin, every sphere of society is directly responsible to God for the operation of its own sphere. Now please turn back to the text. On page 8, I've quoted at length from Dr. Gerard van Groningen of the Reformed Theological Seminary, who deals with the accusation which has been made in recent days by men like Frame, Westminster, that the doctrine of sphere sovereignty is not biblical. If you read that for yourself, you'll see quite clearly that the doctrine of sphere sovereignty most definitely is biblical. Then to page 9. In the unfolding process of Western historical development, the distinction was drawn for the first time in the history of mankind between the state and society, largely due to the struggle during the Middle Ages between the Holy Roman emperors and kings against the popes of Rome. At the Reformation, as I just pointed out, Calvin first distinguished a realm of the things indifferent over which neither the state nor the church as such has any jurisdiction. This realm of culture and economics belongs to the court of conscience
over which neither Pope nor King held sway. In short, Calvin saw the society as a broad field of personal freedom outside the control of the authorities of church and state, in which men and women may associate with each other freely as individuals. Such free associations have, in the course of modern history, given rise to a large number of different social groupings, including business enterprises, schools, newspapers, and so on. Calvin and succeeding reformers have taught that these social spheres must also be recognized as sovereign or independent in their own area of human life. In short, the doctrine of sphere sovereignty guarantees to the individual a sphere of private liberty outside the control of the state. Only by recognizing the religious unity of mankind in Jesus Christ as the second Adam, as well as the essentially limited place and function of such authoritative institutions of the state, can we guarantee the free development of an open rather than a closed society, through which the individual's freedom to respond to his divine calling can express itself. Every authority, an institution or society in the Reformed view, must serve freedom, not for freedom's sake, but because such freedom is the condition of man's vocation, namely to love God and his neighbor as himself. Wherever possible, people must be helped to help themselves by doing the things that need to be done by themselves or in association with others, rather than by looking to the federal or state governments to do everything. For this reason, Christians must reject both fascism and socialism, because they would deprive people of such freedom. Christians then must work to build a truly pluralistic society in America, in which people may enjoy the freedom to live and work out of their own convictions, rather than in accordance with what some federal bureaucrat thinks is good for them. Every person or group of like-minded persons must be enabled to engage in cultural formation in accordance with their own values rather than with those of some so-called secular humanist or radical democratic consensus. Such a scriptural perspective on human society stands, of course, in radical contrast to all forms and expressions of contemporary humanism, be they of the radical right wing or radical left wing of apostate humanism. The biblical view of freedom excludes in principle both apostate individualism and apostate collectivism, and it alone provides us with a theory of society which protects both law and order and freedom and individual enterprise to serve the God of our own choice. This brings us then to the Reformed doctrine of justice and the state. According to the scriptural principle of sphere sovereignty, then it is only in terms of God's absolute and ultimate sovereignty that the true and proper function of the state can be clearly understood. The state is ordained by God to provide and maintain external public justice between the different social spheres. According to the Bible, man has been created in the image of God, and therefore enjoys a measure of free will. And as such, a responsible being, being responsible to his Creator, he must in the last resort be governed by his consent. Thus, to abuse power is to treat a man or woman as an agent or thing of the state. It follows that those who wield power in the state must do so in the name of an authority derived from some source other than themselves, and so entitled to claim the allegiance of men's consciences. In the Reformed view of the state, the officers of the state become the vehicles, not the sources of power. In the Christian tradition of government, this source has been located in the God and Father of the Lord Jesus Christ, and the state has been conceived of as exercising not any messianic functions of redeeming or saving men, as both Wilson and Roosevelt and Nixon seem to imagine, but a ministry of justice. How then does the Christian understand justice in this deep biblical sense? The best answer I find so far to this question has been provided by my good friend Bernard Zylstra. Dr. Zylstra writes, "The norm of justice requires a social order in which men can express themselves as God's images. To put it in different words, the norm of justice requires social space for human personality. By personality, I then mean the human self whose calling lies in love of God and love of fellow men. That calling entails the realization of a multiplicity of tasks and history. Justice, therefore, also requires suetal space for man's cultural tasks. Moreover, the realization of man's central calling also entails the establishment of social institutions like marriage, the family, schools, industries, and the like. Hence, justice requires suetal space for these institutions as well, as long as they contribute to meaningful, harmonious, and an opened-up human existence. Finally, says Zastra, the realization of man's many tasks and callings involves the use of nature and its resources. In view of this, justice also requires such an allocation of material goods that human life is made possible, protected, and enhanced in accordance with its creaturely character, status, and end. In short, justice requires freedom for man's service. That is one of the fruits of Christ's work of redemption, which in principle entails the restoration of creation, also of man's authentic creatureliness and God's imager in the realization of social and cultural tasks or offices. Please skip two paragraphs. In the covenant which God made with Noah, he has ordained the state as a restraint upon human sinfulness. As created in God's image, man is at least in part, due to God's common grace, responsible for his actions. As fallen into sin, he finds it difficult, if not impossible, to fulfill all his duties. Because man has been made in God's image, he is called to reflect in all spheres of his life the religious fullness of meaning of God's creation, which is love. For as St. John tells us, God is love. As such, he is intended to live before the face of his God in all his actions. Because he is a fallen creature, with corruption at the very heart of his being, he needs the restraints of the law, which it is the duty, as God's servant, to enforce. The law of the state must therefore be an expression of that justice which is proper to man's nature. At the same time, such law must provide for and defend man's freedom, because he is a religious being. It must also coerce and restrain him, because he is a deceitful creature prone to evil, whose heart is deceitfully wicked. Now, what sort of a state, in the Reformed view, would best achieve this biblical idea of justice? I think I will go to the board. In the Reformed view, the kind of state which would bring about this biblical idea of justice is best thought of in this way. Now, the state, by divine mandate, founded in the power of the sword. And that goes back to Genesis chapter 9. But, in the Reformed view, the state has to be qualified also by justice. So it's founded in power and qualified by justice. And this immediately gives us a criterion for distinguishing between law of state of the British, American, and Canadian type, based upon the rule of law, constitutions, and power of state, like communism and Nazism and fascism. Now, the tragedy is that America and Britain, I suppose, and Canada are moving away from their old Christian idea of being law state to becoming power state, for the reasons we have already given. Please turn over to page 12. Now, if the state is carrying out its God-ordained function, then its main purpose is to act as the arbitrator for settling disputes between the other various spheres of society. For example, if you have a church congregation meeting on the Lord's Day, and there's a factory next door to that church, and the factory starts making a noise during divine worship, in the Reformed view of the state, the state would have the right to stop that factory from making a noise during the time of divine worship. The state then is ordained by God to maintain justice between all the other independent spheres of society. It is to be the public, legal, integrating factor of society. Does this mean that the Reformed view of the state is a totalitarian one? The answer is in the negative, because this integration does not make the other associations and communities within society intrinsic parts of the state, as in secular humanist theories of government, but a public legal community arises whose purposes are limited by its leading function of public legal justice. In the territorial legal community of the body politic, all these specifically qualified juridical interests should be harmonized in the sense of a truly public legal retribution against lawbreakers and integrated into the public interest. But this term, public interest, must never be used as an excuse for any sort of political program designed to collectivize society, but must always be juridically or legally qualified, since its use may never warrant an encroachment upon the internal sphere sovereignty of the non-political spheres relationships such as family, church, industry, and trade. We must see this public interest in the context of all God's other ordinances and offices. Only then can the limitation of what the public interest constitutes be balanced successfully against the private interest. For the limits of both the public and private interest can be found only in the divine institution of the various offices of human life. In each of these offices, God maintains his sovereignty and authority in a particular way that is appropriate to each office. The state, that is to say, exists to promote the common good. The office bearers of the state must thus exercise their authority in accordance with the requirements of justice, not of political expediency. Thus, the divinely imposed task of the government, underlined, is to establish the legal framework for all the other spheres. It must maintain the public order of justice, so that both individuals and associations may be protected in their various authorities. The state's duty is to regulate, according to the criterion of the legal public interest, every citizen's, every social sphere's external relations to all the other spheres, so that citizens and associations may flourish and grow in peace. 1 Timothy 2, 1-3. The public interest is thus understood more in the sense of carrying out God's justice for the various realms of society than in any socialistic sense of the welfare state or in the fascist sense of the welfare of special interest groups, such as big business or big unions. The state, in the Reform view, is not the whole, of which all the other spheres are only its subservient parts. For this reason, the basic principle of the juridical aspect of the state is judgment, or justice. The well-balanced harmonization of a multiplicity of interests and the public law of the state must therefore seek to uphold harmonious relationships between all the interests within its territory. This process consists in the weighing of the various interests of society against each other in the scales of justice, so that each receives its just and proper due, based upon the recognition of the sphere sovereignty of the various social spheres. Well, please turn over 3 pages. 2 pages to page 14. And the other pages we just skipped, I deal with the Roman Catholic theory of society, which advocates precisely what I've been attacking, namely the corporate state of fascism, as its ideal platform for the reorganization of modern society. And this is what Mussolini tried to carry out in fascist Italy. But I believe that such a corporate state is even more dangerous to our freedoms than is socialism. The middle of page 14. The two great mutually exclusive contemporary opponents of a free society, as we have known it in the Anglo-Saxon world, are collectivism or socialism and syndicalism or fascism. Both recommend the integration of society by means of the erection and maintenance of monopolies. Neither finds any virtue in the diffusion of power, or what we have called sphere sovereignty. But both must be considered mutually exclusive opponents of a free society, because the monopoly favored by syndicalism or fascism would make both a collective or a free society impossible. In a certain sense, syndicalism or the corporate state of fascism is an even greater threat to our liberties than socialism in its Western version. Syndicalism and the so-called corporate state of Roman Catholicism would not only destroy our historic Anglo-American-Canadian freedoms, they would also destroy any kind of orderly existence. Syndicalism rejects both the concentration of overwhelming power in the government and the wide dispersion of power, which is the basis of freedom. Syndicalism is a contrivance by means of which society is disposed for a perpetual civil war, in which the parties are the organized self-interests of functional minorities, such as big business and big unions, and a weak central government, and for which the community as a whole pays the bill in monopoly prices and disorder. The great concentrations of power in a syndicalist society are the pillars of labor organized in functional monopoly associations. All monopolies are prejudicial to freedom. There's good reason for supposing that a management labor monopoly would be most dangerous of all, and that a society in the grip of such a monopoly would enjoy less freedom than any other sort of society. The consumers would certainly suffer as the syndicalist industrial groupings fix prices to suit their own conveniences rather than those of the general public and the consumers. In other words, here you have a movement in the opposite direction. Instead of the state encroaching upon all the other spheres that society has under socialism, under fascism or syndicalism, as I call it, you have big business and big unions encroaching not only upon the sphere of the government, using the government to further their own interests. You have both these trying to take over the rest of society. So they also are opposed to the biblical norm of sphere sovereignty. Turn over, please, to page 16. Now, what we're trying to get at then is a policy for society in which each sphere carries out its own God-ordained functions and doesn't try to continually interfere in the operation of other spheres. A man who has done a great deal in developing this reformed view of society has been Professor Herman Dooyeweerd of the Free University of Amsterdam. Now, Dooyeweerd holds that industrial and commercial life is the result of a process of economic differentiation during the course of history, by means of which it has come to develop its own inner nature and its own principles. This is the principle of free economic enterprise qualified by capital and labor, which must not be absorbed by the state if society is to develop in freedom as God has ordained. For this independent function of free enterprise is inseparably related to the principles of risk, profit, and mutual competition. And the profits earned are wholly justified when we consider the services which free enterprise offers to human society. As we've seen in the development of our society by means of modernization, there grew up the free enterprise system which provided the economic base for our high standard of living. According to Duverwoerd and the reformed economists of the Free University, the only efficiency to be considered is the most economical way of supplying the things men desire to purchase. The form or circumstance in which this may be done at its maximum is where enterprise is effectively competitive. For here the entrepreneur is merely the intermediary between consumers of goods and sellers of services. Of course, there is always the danger of the abuse of the profit motive. But this is not the primary feature of free enterprise, and it may be curbed. The regulation of the profit feature of free enterprise by the government must not, however, involve the removal of the business entrepreneur from our society, since freedom of business enterprise depends upon spiritual liberty and responsibility. As soon as industry becomes a branch of the state, as under communism or socialism, then this freedom comes to depend upon the centralized planning of the government experts, and that would entail a usurpation of power by the state. Moreover, citizens have a God-given right not to be economically directed and controlled by the government. It is ironical to say the least, while that centralized planning is increasing in Western societies, the communists are being forced to revert to free enterprise. And finally, the conclusion, please, page 17. The biblical understanding of God's justice, then, requires that the state act as his servant in providing all its citizens with enough social space so they can develop their personalities as God's image bearers in peace and freedom. This means, as we have seen, acting as the integrator of public justice by preventing any one individual or social grouping from exploiting or dominating any other social sphere. Judged by this biblical norm of sphere sovereignty, the present corporate state that now rules America is contrary to God's law, as well as inimical to the rights and liberties of the citizens of our land. The federal government must therefore be made to give up its unholy alliances with big business and big unionism, and restore proper competition within the private sector of our economy. It must also be made to stop interfering within the internal affairs of business firms and labor unions, except where these organizations infringe upon the rights and liberties of citizens and other associations and communities. For example, forcing people to work on Sundays or joining secular unions on pain of losing their jobs. The Lord, in his goodness and grace, has laid down his own great ordinances for the successful operation of each sphere of human life. When men and women obey these laws, they are blessed. Psalm 1:1-3. And they come under God's judgment when they disobey them. In these lectures, we have examined some of these laws as they apply to the great sphere of economics, such as the law of supply and demand, the law of scarcity and a diminishing return, the law of the intrinsic value of gold and silver. Let American businessmen obey these laws of industry and trade, and they will be blessed. Let them stop trying to climb out from under them by calling to the federal government to subsidize or otherwise bail them out of their troubles at the taxpayer's expense. Likewise, let the labor unions stop trying to enhance their own position in society by using the power of the sort of government to obtain their own objectives. Let both managers and workers instead seek to glorify God by their labors. By setting up protective tariffs, import quotas, wage and price controls, inflating the supply of paper money, the federal bureaucrats at the U.S. Treasury, the Federal Reserve Board, the Labor Relations Board, and all the other organs of the federal bureaucracy have wreaked havoc with the proper working of the price system for the past 70 years. As we have seen, it was not the free market economy which brought about the Great Depression of the 1930s, but the Federal Reserve Board. If left alone, the price system of the free market is capable of allocating the best use of the earth, of the scarce resources of the earth, and hence of enabling us to act as good stewards of the Earth's resources. No federal bureaucrat has the mental capacity or ingenuity to match the price system of the free market economy when it comes to deciding what shall be produced, how much will be produced, and how it shall be produced. To determine what goods and services society shall produce, the price system sets up incentives for business firms to produce what consumers want. To the extent they produce what consumers want and are willing to pay for, firms reap profits. Similarly, the price system sets up strong incentives for firms to produce these goods and services with the maximum efficiency and at minimum cost. The incentives take the form of profits for firms that minimize costs and losses for firms that operate with too high costs. And so again, the price system, unlike government planning, encourages good stewardship. To determine who gets what, the price system results in each person's receiving an income that depends upon the quantity of resources and talents that he owns and upon his own marginal productivity to the firm or business for which he works. In other words, his wage depends upon the contribution he makes. Most important of all, the price system of the free market increases the society's per capita income by pushing out the production possibility frontier. No government in history has been able to achieve any one of these feats alone, let alone all of them together, as does the price system of the free market economy. Despite these tremendous advantages, critics of the price system have argued it should be replaced by some other mechanism for solving our society's basic economic problems. They have claimed that the distribution of income generated by the price system is unfair, since it rewards those with high incomes and punishes those with little or no income. In reply to this criticism, we can first point out that inequalities of income are far greater in the Soviet planned economy than they are in our own free market economy. Secondly, the independent sector can handle the problem of workers who become sick or are too old to work far better than any government bureaucrat. In his book, Reclaiming the American Dream, Richard Cornell has showed how this is possible. We also dealt with the problem of poverty in our lectures last year before the first Summer Institute of the Christian Studies Center. In our view, the independent sector of society, that is, groups like churches, all parts of society which are not government or which aren't business. In our view, then, the independent sector of society can handle welfare problems far more efficiently and humanely than any government department. The American nation is now faced with a choice between solving society's economizing problem by means of continued government interference and planning in the private sector, and thereby eventually enslaving the whole population, or by restoring a truly free and responsible market economy in which the price system will be allowed to operate. It is vital that we all realize before it is too late that collectivism and freedom are real alternatives. If we choose the corporate state of fascism or socialism, we cannot have the free market system. And collectivism can be imposed upon a gullible electorate with an appearance of not destroying the continuity with our historic traditions of limited government and the rule of law, only if enough Americans lose or forget their love of personal freedom under God. Today, as ever before, the price of our liberties is eternal vigilance. The more Christians champion planning or the corporate state as the cure-all for society's present ills, as many liberal churchmen have been doing for a generation, the less possibility they will leave themselves and others for a final resistance to and escape from all the bitter consequences. At present, many Christians seem to have adopted a middle position between the free market economy and collectivism. They believe in the virtues of the free enterprise economy, yet they make no stand in principle against the growing power of the federal government. The growth in government expenditures at all levels, federal, state, and local, has been fantastic. Just please turn to the chart at the end, where we take it up to 1970. I give you there the tremendous increase in government expenditures from 1930 right through to 1970. Now you might just add that in 1973 it reached about $400 billion. The rate has been climbing since 1929, as shown in the appendix chart. Since our nation's total output was about $1.2 trillion in 1973, this means the government expenditures are now about one-third of our total output. Yet in 1929, the ratio was only about 10%. Of these vast sums, defense spending, education, and social security and welfare payments accounted for about two-thirds of all federal, state, and local government spending. If these trends continue, we shall eventually all become wage slaves of the government. The choice is placed. Either we choose to be governed by God, or we hand over our freedoms to the government. The only hope for the survival of freedom in America today is if enough Christians and citizens recover their faith in the sovereignty of the Lord Jesus Christ over all aspects of their life, and if they only look to Him and not to their government for their salvation. Only by living in responsible freedom before the face of our God can we now hope to avoid becoming enslaved by our own government. Freedom will not survive in these United States unless Americans, first of all, wish to be free. The only way to be free is by joining forces with fellow believers in building up our own Christian associations and organizations, and to struggle for a pluralistic rather than a collectivistic or syndicalistic organization of our society. If such free associations are genuinely seeking to maintain their own authentic existence by safeguarding their own independence from government control, then they need have no fear of their future. Let us then, in America, multiply our associations if we would remain free. But here, as in the realm of personal freedom, the condition of our corporate freedoms is eternal vigilance. Unless the will to be independent of government control exists in human hearts, no institution can hope to resist encroachment by the modern Leviathan state. Such a will to freedom has in actual historical experience been found to arise only out of a living faith in the crown rights of our Redeemer, Jesus Christ, over all of our life. This should not be surprising, for did not the Lord Jesus Christ himself tell us, "I am the way, the truth, and the life"? Only as we walk in his way, believe in his truth, and share in his risen and victorious life, can we hope to remain free of domination by the apostate forces of darkness, which today, more than ever before, are seeking to destroy the glorious liberty of the sons and daughters of the living God. And now unto him who is able to keep us from falling and to present us faultless before the presence of his glory with exceeding joy, to the only wise God our Savior, be glory and majesty, dominion and power, both now and ever. Amen. Thank you.